I'm Jeff Sickinga, Executive Director of the Ashbrook Center, and this is The American Idea, where we discuss the ideas, people, and events that have made America what it is today. We believe that by understanding our history and our principles, we can better live up to the promise of the American founding and preserve our ongoing experiment in self-government. Welcome to The American Idea.
Welcome, everyone, to this episode of The American Idea. Today, we're going to be talking about a topic that's in the news, but really actually goes all the way back to the founding of the country. And that is, what do Americans do after an election? After a new president is inaugurated, how does the country respond? And of course, we have seen a very contested presidential election in 2024, but it's not the first time in American history, and maybe not even the most bitterly contested. That honor probably goes, as I think our guest today would argue, to the election of 1800 between Thomas Jefferson and John Adams. What did Jefferson say in his inaugural speech to try and unify the country? What effect did it have? Did it work? Did it not work? And what about the reconciliation later in life of Thomas Jefferson and John Adams, one of the great stories of American history? And again, I'm joined for that conversation today by my personal friend, a great friend of the Ashbrook Center, an occasional co-host of, in fact, the American Idea podcast, Dr. Kara Rogers Stevens. Dr. Stevens is, as many of you know, professor of history here at Ashland University, teaches in many of Ashbrook's programs for students, teachers, and for citizens. She is one of the nation's leading scholars on Thomas Jefferson and has published a terrific book on Jefferson and the problem of slavery, which, according to one reviewer this past year, called it one of the best books ever written on Thomas Jefferson. High praise indeed, but well-deserved. Kara, thanks for joining me on The American Idea.
It's my pleasure, Jeff. I'm happy to be here again.
Thomas Jefferson and John Adams, the election of 1800. I think our listeners who are pretty historically informed, as you know that was a bitter election, really bitter election. Before we talk about Jefferson's inaugural and how he tried to bridge the divide, just remind us the depths of the division and bitterness in 1800.
Yeah, so as many of our listeners might remember from some of our previous podcast episodes around this topic, the years leading up to the election of 1800 were some of the most divisive, and they were also extraordinary in the history of America, and you could even argue in the history of the world, because America was trying an experiment. We were trying out a large republic for the first time in the history of the world to see if a large group of people could govern themselves successfully through a republican system. And while George Washington was our president, the people of America were fairly unified. Washington was such a cohesive figure. He was such a figure who commanded respect and admiration from people with many different views. But during Washington's administration, two distinct political parties formed, and these parties were led by Alexander Hamilton and John Adams on the one hand, and by Thomas Jefferson and James Madison on the other. And these two parties feared one another. And when I get discouraged about contemporary American politics, I try to remember that even the founding fathers could sometimes believe the worst of one another as well. That John Adams truly believed that Thomas Jefferson could be, or at least Jefferson's party and his ideas, could be dangerous to the future of America. And Jefferson could really believe that Alexander Hamilton wanted to crown himself king. And the political organs, the newspaper editors and the faction leaders on the local levels really said despicable things about people from the other side, from the other party. And so you see Americans really start to hate one another, to fear one another, and to fear for the future in the years leading up to the election of 1800. There were concerns about foreign policy. There were concerns about immigration, dangerously changing the character of the nation. There were fears about free speech being dangerous, maybe spreading too much disinformation. There were laws suppressing free speech. There were people arrested for criticizing the government. Lots of echoes of things that might sound eerily familiar to Americans today, leading up to that election. And I would argue maybe the only election where we've been more divided is 1860, where we ended in the Civil War. But before that, 1800 takes the cake.
So it's a bitter time. It's a divisive time, as you say. But we, of course, we hold the election. And for the first time, there is a peaceful transfer of power between parties, from the Federalists to the Democratic Republicans in the presidency and in Congress. It seems like the Democratic Republicans really sweep the day politically on the federal level. It's probably not clear to people how Thomas Jefferson, as the leader of that party, is going to react. Is it going to be a kind of revolutionary purge of the opposition, as we've seen many times and has happened in France? Or is there going to be some higher, better, nobler, more conciliatory approach? What approach does Jefferson take?
Jefferson he's an interesting political figure. I like to describe him to my students as an introvert. So back in the years of the Revolutionary War, when Jefferson and John Adams first became friends, John Adams actually respected Jefferson because Jefferson would stand quietly in the back of the room and he did not make enemies. He listened. And really where Jefferson came alive was in his pen, in his writings. But in person, even Jefferson's personal enemies or political enemies would say that it was difficult to hate him when you were in the room with the man. He was easy to get along with. Adams, on the other hand, referred to himself as suspected, obnoxious, and unpopular. Adams knew that he could be bombastic, and he easily gained enemies because he was just so blunt and honest, which I have to admit, I love that about him. So Thomas Jefferson, he wasn't somebody who personally gained a lot of enemies from people who knew him, but because of his writings and because of what he represented with his political party, the Democratic Republicans, lots of Federalists had reason to fear that when he was elected, he would retaliate against them. And in particular, they might have been thinking about the alien and sedition laws that the Federalist Party had passed that had prosecuted several Jeffersonian Republicans for criticizing John Adams. And so people worried, was Jefferson going to put his political opponents in jail? Was he going to cut down on their free speech? Was he going to completely get rid of every Federalist in a federal position in government and replace them all with Democratic Republicans? And so Jefferson stands up to give his inaugural address, March 4th, 1801, and he read it so quietly that hardly anybody could hear what he said because he was terrible at public speaking. But it was printed in the newspapers, and so people were able to read his sentiments. And I have to tell you, it's one of my favorite inaugural addresses in American history, because Jefferson used his power of the pen to reassure and to give a brilliant and beautiful statement of his political principles that really do reflect what he would then aim to accomplish over the next years of his presidency.
So he, in his inaugural, he outlines, as you say, sort of his political philosophy, the ideas and principles that are going to govern the Jefferson administration. And we know some of those are calls for limited government, calls for individual liberty. But also, as you said, there's some important lines in there, as I recall, calls for national unity. And in particularly, olive branches to the Federalists. What does Jefferson say about that?
So in the second paragraph, Jefferson starts out by reassuring people who maybe are looking at the American political process and thinking, my gosh, those American Republicans are crazy. He says, during the contest of opinion through which we have passed, the animation of discussions and of exertions has sometimes worn an aspect which might impose on strangers unused to think freely and to speak and to write what they think. But this being now decided by the voice of the nation, announced according to the rules of the Constitution, all will, of course, arrange themselves under the will of the law and unite in common efforts for the common good. So in other words, Jefferson acknowledges that the election was rancorous, that it was very animated, that people were cruel and vicious sometimes in their political attacks on one another. But now that the election has been decided, Jefferson says, all right, we have a constitution, we're going to arrange ourselves under the constitution, and we're going to unite and move forward. And he continues to say, all too will bear in mind the sacred principle that though the will of the majority is in all cases to prevail, that will, to be rightful, must be reasonable. That the minority possess their equal rights, which equal law must protect, and to violate would be oppression. And this must have been very reassuring for Federalists to hear that line, that Jefferson, he knows that he has a mandate to govern, to use some modern terminology, but he is not going to oppress his political enemies. He's not going to violate the rights of the minority, because the entire point of America is that we are equal under the law and under the Constitution, and that even the minority keep their equal rights after they lose an election.
Can I just ask you, Cara, is that may have been surprising to Federalists who feared the worst, at least those who did fear the worst of Jefferson. Is that surprising to you that Jefferson would say that?
Not in the slightest. Jefferson, he's a complicated figure for us to understand in 2024 because he's most closely associated with slavery, which of course is the oppression of people's rights. But the more that I study Jefferson, what I find intriguing about him is that he was self-aware enough to realize that slavery was oppression. And he actually, as I document in my book, spent his life pointing out the hypocrisy of slavery, trying to build a case against it, and trying to stand for freedom and the rights of humankind in a way that is remarkable for somebody of his time and place. Somebody that was born at a time of hierarchy and oppression and slavery being normal, for him to have taken such stands on behalf of freedom and liberty are really remarkable. And so when we find Jefferson as president making these statements on behalf of, yes, majority rule, but equal rights under the law, this is entirely consistent with everything else that I have read Jefferson saying in the course of his career. Now, let's not put him up on a pedestal. He's still human. He did still do things that we can criticize, from not doing more to free more enslaved individuals to, as president, certainly there were times that he maybe engaged in removing somebody from office for political reasons rather than more reasons of cause. Or there are a couple of cases where he supported a prosecution of somebody who had, he would say they'd maybe engaged in some libel. But somebody could say, no, that was a political prosecution. So Jefferson's not perfect by any means. But in this inaugural address, he is making the case for the principles that he has dedicated his public life to promoting. And I think that he does it very well. He makes a strong case for Americans being tolerant of one another after a rancorous election, and of upholding the law and the Constitution above all else.
Before we continue with our discussion, I'd like to let you know about an outstanding set of programs that Ashbrook sponsors for high school students, the Ashbrook Academy.
Do you know any students with an interest in American history, politics, economics, and literature? Do they enjoy being academically challenged and the thrill of engaging with different ideas and viewpoints? Hi, I'm Sabrina Maristella, Student Programs Coordinator here at the Ashbrook Center. The Ashbrook Academy is a series of summer courses for rising high school juniors and seniors. Held in person at Ashland University, the Academy immerses you in the American story like you've never been before. Since 2015, our approach has taken history out of textbooks and into students' lives with historical documents and conversations about those documents. If you are a rising high school junior or senior, or if you know someone who is, We invite you to learn more about our courses and apply today at ashbrookacademy.org.
Yeah, it's interesting to me what he goes on to say in the inaugural, which is that, and just as you were saying, during the election of 1800, the Federalists really thought, or at least some Federalists, many Federalists maybe, really thought that the Democratic Republicans were Jacobins, that they were going to unleash terror in the streets.
That's right.
Revolution. But then, of course, the Democratic Republicans thought many Federalists were monarchists, right? And were going to try and love the British monarchy and crown themselves or establish some kind of higher aristocracy or monarchy. They both sides, in many ways, really believed the other had betrayed the cause of a republic, a constitutional right. republic. What does Jefferson go on to say in the inaugural about the idea, well, wait a minute, maybe, in fact, we actually share certain principles that the heat of the election and the vituperation of the election kind of clouded over?
Yeah. Yeah, there's a couple of really famous lines here where he mentions those two political parties. So in this second paragraph that we've been looking at, in the middle of that paragraph, he says, every difference of opinion is not a difference of principle. We have called by different names brethren of the same principle. We are all Republicans. We are all Federalists. Now, is Jefferson saying myself and John Adams and Alex Hamilton are exactly the same? No, but he's acknowledging that at their core, these are men who are devoted to some of the same principles. And yes, they have differences of opinion. And in his private moments, he would maybe express even more concern about the consequences of some of those differences of opinion. But in this speech, he chooses to emphasize the unity at their core, that these are people who love America. And then I have to say, the very next thing that Jefferson goes on to do is to acknowledge, even if somebody wants to dissolve the Union or to change the Republic and the core format of the Union, that's okay. He says, let those people stand undisturbed as monuments of the safety with which error of opinion may be tolerated, where reason is left free to combat it. You can be a moron in America, Jefferson says. That's okay. You have the freedom to be as dumb as you want, to support the dangerous ideas. You can freely speak about that. We will let you stand undisturbed as a monument, because we also have freedom here for reason to combat bad ideas. And Jefferson, he's an optimist, but he's a great advocate of free speech and a freedom of thought. And here he's really expressing his faith in the American people, that if we can just debate freely, the best ideas, the right ideas, the truth will win in the end.
And is he referring in that passage to when he says brethren of the same principle? Is he really talking about sort of, for example, principles of the Declaration of Independence that both he and Adams would have did support during that revolutionary moment in 1776?
I think that's a fair assumption. Jefferson, of course, is famous for writing about the American mind and how he himself didn't make up all of the ideas of the Declaration of Independence on his own. He was expressing common principles, common ideas, common values that were held by the men of 1776 that he still believed in 1800 people like John Adams were devoted to. The concept of equality and liberty and the pursuit of happiness. And so he's reminding, I think, people in 1800 of what they had gone through together, what they had fought for, what their core values really were, what it meant to be an American. And he's trying to call them back to the Declaration and to remind them of what it really means to be an American. Yeah, we can be Federalists, we can be Republicans. He later on says we can with confidence and courage pursue our own federal and Republican principles so long as we have an attachment to union and to representative government. That's what he's really calling people back to.
Well, despite the calls for unity, I mean, it certainly has a great public effect, but of course, privately, he and Adams, it's not like they become fast friends again, right? What happens in the relationship between Adams and Jefferson after Adams loses and Jefferson takes office?
This is one of the coolest stories in American history. Thomas Jefferson and John Adams have a falling out, to put it mildly, because of this horrible election, this very bitter election of 1800. And John Adams had been personally going through a difficult time. One of his sons had died. I think he was offended that he wasn't reelected to a second term in office. So he left Washington, D.C., and did not even attend the inauguration of his successor, Thomas Jefferson. And they didn't speak. They did not write to one another. They did not see one another for something like a decade, more than a decade. And this was personally painful, but it was also painful to their friends, to people who knew and cared about both Adams and Jefferson. And I would also argue it was bad for the country that these two founding fathers had so much personal as well as political bitterness between the two of them. And we, as a country, owe a great debt to a founding father named Benjamin Rush. He's one of the great figures of modern medicine. He doesn't get enough credit for his great contributions to science. But his papers weren't really publicized, and so he's been a little bit of a historical secret until fairly recently. But look up Benjamin Rush, fascinating guy, friends with both Adams and Jefferson. And he started a project, a concerted effort to reconcile these two founding fathers after Jefferson retired from office. He even wrote to John Adams that he had had a dream, and in his dream, Adams reached out with a couple of friendly sentences to Jefferson, and Jefferson wrote back, and it started a correspondence that lasted for years and that reconciled the two founders. And Adams wrote back and said, well, your dream might be a prophecy. We'll have to wait and see. Sure enough, that's actually what happened. A few years later, Adams wrote a line to Thomas Jefferson. Jefferson wrote back, and it opened up a correspondence between these two founders. They never talked face to face, but they wrote letters back and forth, and they had this beautiful line. I believe it was Adams who wrote to Jefferson, "You and I ought not to die until we have explained ourselves to one another." And that's what they did for years. They explained why they had disagreed. They explained, they tried to uncover some of these political and personal misunderstandings, and they covered their hopes and their fears for the future of the nation in a beautiful series of letters that show us that the American mind, it was still alive in both of them, that they really were men of the same principle, and that enabled them to reconcile despite this period of partisan bitterness that they had gone through.
In that correspondence, the Adams Jefferson letters, do we find that they end up coming to agreement on everything?
No. No, I think that we find there's some instances in which they had more agreement than what they thought. And there are other areas in which they were never going to agree. So they, for example, had a disagreement about aristocracy. Adams was a little bit more of a pessimist. He believed that rich people, beautiful people, intelligent or well-educated, well-connected people, they would be the ones who would get political power always, because it's just human nature, and that the government needed to be organized in such a way as to protect democracy from perhaps the powerful rich doing too much damage. Jefferson, more of an optimist, believed in natural aristocracy, believed that it was possible in America for Americans to, through a system of public education and scholarships, promote the wisest and most virtuous, not just the rich and well-connected. They never changed their minds on those fundamental positions. They had different worldviews. But those two points are not that incompatible. And I think that once the fear and the anger of the election of 1800 had passed, Jefferson and Adams were able to discuss these issues in a much calmer manner, a much more productive manner.
It's interesting to me that as the course of their correspondence goes on, which, as you say, starts about 1813, right? And goes till they both die amazingly on July 4th, 1826. Well, it's beautiful to think that Adams and Jefferson reconcile later in life. Of course, they have family members. Do their family members also join them in this reconciliation? Because sometimes people can reconcile, but their family members don't forget the past. What happens with the Adams family and with Thomas Jefferson?
Yes. So in particular, our audience might be familiar with two famous members of the Adams family, Abigail Adams, John's wife, and then John Quincy Adams, John Adams's son. And interestingly, I believe that Abigail Adams had a harder time forgiving Thomas Jefferson than what her husband did. She took it very personally when her husband was being attacked when he was president. She hated that there were attacks on his appearance, on his character, and she held Jefferson to some extent responsible for those political attacks, even though Jefferson himself never wrote or said any of those more crude things. Abigail was angry at him, and she and Thomas Jefferson did exchange a couple of letters. She did reach out in sympathy after the death of Jefferson's daughter, but they were not able to reconcile. And that's sad. It's maybe also a cautionary tale that a spouse might carry an offense longer than the actual injured party. Jefferson did try to reach out to her. And John Quincy Adams, John Adams' son, had also a very tough time with Thomas Jefferson and had written some anonymous attack ads against Jefferson himself in his youth. So there was not as much love lost there. But the fact that Jefferson and John Adams were able to reconcile as thoroughly as they were still is a remarkable part of American history.
And what about July 4th, 1826, the day that both of them died?
Yeah, Americans at the time were astounded to discover that two of the last remaining signers of the Declaration, two of the nation's first presidents, leaders of the first political parties, would pass away within hours of one another on July 4th. And it was the 25th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence. It seemed providential. It seemed as though this was a sign from God, and a blessing from God in a way, that the nation had endured as long as what it had, and that its two of its greatest founding fathers had reconciled and had lived out their lives and the fullness of their lives until the anniversary of the Declaration in that way. It's interesting, Adams's last words were something along the lines of, "Jefferson still lives." And I think that that wasn't actually because he knew that Jefferson was still alive, but rather because, in a way, Adams knew that Jefferson's reputation would always be a little bit more predominant in the American imagination, that because Jefferson was the author of the Declaration, his ideas and the way that he was able to put into words of America's mind would always be alive.
Wow, what a moving story, and so important for us to remember in this time of inauguration, the importance of understanding ourselves as Americans as brethren of the same principle. Kara, thanks for taking the time to illuminate this really wonderful moment in American history, full of some difficulties, challenges, divisions, but ultimately a call back to unity and friendship. Appreciate you taking the time to join me today on The American Idea.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to talk with you about these things too.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The American Idea. If you enjoyed this episode, remember to subscribe at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, and leave a 5-star review. If you want to learn more or get involved in Ashbrook's vital work, visit our website, ashbrook.org.